I'm Carrie Nolan, in for Leonard Lopate on WNYC and WNYC.org. Well, today is Friday the 13th. It's thought by some as an inauspicious date. Magical thinking and superstitions exist all over the world, but where do superstitious beliefs come from, and how do they affect people's behavior? Well, here to explain are Stuart Weiss, professor of psychology at Connecticut College and author of Believing in Magic, The Psychology of Superstition, and Edmund Kern. He's associate professor of psychology at Lawrence University. Gentlemen, welcome.
Nice to be here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure. Stuart, let me start with you. Can you define superstition and magical thinking?
Well, there are different ways to do that. The two defining aspects that I have used in trying to define superstition are, first of all, a belief or behavior that it contradicts sort of the known scientific knowledge of the time, and also that is in some way pragmatic, either trying to bring about a good end or avoid a bad one.
Go ahead.
Those are the two things, non-scientific and pragmatic.
So superstition doesn't always just then focus on avoiding those bad things, on fear and negative outcomes.
Oh, no. In fact, there's sort of a difference between the two. I think I feel a little bit more kindly towards the positive superstitions, the ones that are aimed at bringing about a good end.
Knocking on wood, for example?
Yes, exactly, yes.
Okay. Ed, let's turn to you for a moment. Do superstitions exist in all cultures?
Pretty much. I think that you could find kinds of thinking, kinds of behaving that we would identify as superstitious. There's certainly a long history of practices that we in the 21st century would feel comfortable labeling superstitious from our own sort of scientific explanation of the world, a kind of very rational cause and effect approach to understanding the world around us. Most cultures, particularly the further back we go in time, have ways of explaining, our relationship to the universe around us in ways that we might, perfectly justified in labeling superstitious.
Well, it seems like many people have, or at least they're aware of superstitions. You know, the number 13 being bad luck, breaking a mirror, leading to 7 years of bad luck. But very few people seem to know where these beliefs even come from or even why we believe them. What do you make of that?
Well, I have a couple of different answers to that. First of all, my training is as a historian rather than a psychologist,
right,
as you mentioned earlier. And, I've often joked that anybody who tells you that they know the real origin or source of a superstition is lying to you. And the reason I say that is that, as historians, the best we can do is take a look at the historical record and note when certain superstitious practices are referred to or when superstitious practices are explained. Just because someone in the past explains the origin of a superstition in a certain way doesn't mean that that's really the origin of the superstition. And let me just give you one quick example.
Sure.
Of that. In the 18th and 19th century, in books of manners, for example, in England, oftentimes you would find authors referring to Friday as an inauspicious day upon which to have a dinner party. And sometimes they would go a step further and say, and as we all know, this was the day upon which our Lord and Savior was crucified. Certainly a lot of people draw that kind of association between the crucifixion of Jesus of Nazareth and Friday as a day of ill omen. But we really have no, absolute proof, so to speak, that that's where the notion first emerged.
Stuart, children seem to come up with many of their own superstitions. Are they kind of absorbing from their parents, or are there innate human superstitions?
Well, I think that the sort of activity of trying to draw conclusions or make meaning out of the things that we see is perhaps innately human. And children do that in a childish way. They will create a magical belief about the fact that as I walk, the moon is following me, or that other kinds of things, step on a crack, you break your mother's back.
I was just thinking of that very one.
Exactly. I mean, it is a common and sort of sweet, childish, what is sometimes referred to as a half belief. Some of these, of course, are transmitted. We all learned step on a crack from someone else, and so childhood is the time during which you acquire a number of superstitious beliefs, just as a feature of being in the culture and growing up within them. These are aspects of our culture that it changes depending upon which culture you're in. But we all acquire them that way. But also, children are not fully adults yet, and so it seems to me that we can't expect them to think quite as logically as adults do about these things. And children's literature is filled with magic and other kinds of non-scientific things, and so it's only natural that they would acquire these kinds of superstitions as in youth. I think we kind of judge them differently if they're carried into adulthood, though.
We're talking about superstitions on this Friday the 13th with Stuart Weiss, professor of psychology at Connecticut College, and Edmund Kern, who's associate professor of history at Lawrence University. I'm Carrie Nolan in for Leonard Lopate. And if you'd like to speak with either of our experts about superstitions, maybe not the entirely the etymology of them, but if you have some superstition that you believe in, maybe, do you believe that it's unlucky to have a dinner party on a Friday, and particularly the Friday the 13th, give us a call. Our number is 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Stuart, can you explain what a phrase called confirmation bias is?
Sure. This is a common psychological phenomenon which basically states that once you hold a belief, then you have a bias typically towards confirming it. And that means that in the case of a superstition, if you, for example, believe that the full moon is unlucky, or that Friday the 13th, for that matter, is unlucky, then you have a tendency to make note of and remember those instances that confirm that belief, and you are less likely to remember or even notice things that disconfirm it. So once you've acquired one of these superstitions, this of course applies to any belief,
sure,
political beliefs or anything else. It's not just superstition, but once you acquire a belief, it tends to guide your assessment of the data that either supports or refutes it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, we'll get back to that, but I'm curious to know how superstition is related to religion. I'll open that up to either of you.
Well, it's a question that I get often, and what I would say is that of course it's a sort of personal value statement, I think, the way you address this question, But I would argue that, and this is a position that was held, for example, by Stephen Jay Gould, the evolutionary biologist, that science and religion are two great ways of thinking, and that in many ways they don't overlap. That the world of religion, much of the world of religion, is taken on faith and is not really subject to proof in the same way that science is. And so he saw these as two sort of magisterial ways of thinking that don't overlap. What I would argue is that when religion makes claims that are testable and that are about the natural world, then I'm the kind of person who would want to see evidence of that. So, for example, if someone says that they can heal people by praying over them or other kinds of activities like that, or in the case of a transcendental meditation person, that they can levitate by meditating and float above the ground, then I would like to see the evidence of that, since those ideas are testable, are in the realm of the natural world, and I value that kind of evidence personally. So I would say that in many cases they don't overlap, and in those cases where they do, I'd like to see the evidence.
Yeah, one interesting point to keep in mind is that, you know, notions of what counts as the superstitious or what counts as the religious change over time. So, for example, you know, our word in modern English, superstition, comes from the Latin superstitio, which had some fairly precise meanings among the ancients. Most commonly, it meant sort of an excessive fear of the numinous, or an excessive fear of the supernatural, which led to a kind of scrupulous or excessive religious practice. Sometimes, however, superstition, in other words, was simply used to describe an alien religion. That is, one adopted the perspective of an insider within a particular religious tradition, looked at outsiders who followed different religious traditions, and labeled them superstitious. So, for example, we find Tacitus in the first century denouncing Christians as superstitious in his work, The Annals. But we also find Christians denouncing the Jews as superstitious as well. In other words, following a kind of, if not exactly false belief, at least a kind of alien belief. Although I do agree with what Stuart said earlier about our distinctions between science and religion nowadays. Religion, he is quite right, is really an argument in many respects about what is not testable through science. And when it does make claims that are testable, then, you know, science can in fact enter into the equation and, you know, help settle the matter, so to speak.
We're talking about superstition with Stuart Weiss, professor of psychology at Connecticut College, and Edmund Kern, associate professor of history at Lawrence University. And we'd like to take your calls. Our number is 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Paul in Larchmont, welcome to the show. You with us, Paul?
I'm interested in what your guests were saying earlier about children and superstition. My daughter, she just turned 5, but several months ago she started doing the step on the crack thing.
Mm-hmm.
And she wouldn't say step on the on a crack, break your mother's back. She said it brought bad luck or something like that. And I said, did you learn that? I asked who taught her that. And she said, no, she insisted that she made it up herself. And I asked my therapist about it, and she said that this is the age at which kids start to realize that they, you know, that the world is so big and they have no control over it, and their parents don't run the universe, and so they develop these superstitions themselves in order to assert control, or the illusion of control, over a world which they really don't control at all. And I just thought that was interesting.
I think that's fascinating. I also remember when I was a kid, there was the step on a crack, break your mother's back. Then there was also step on a crack, break the devil's back. And so you would stomp all over those cracks on your way home.
Right. But I think that it's possible that these...
Sorry. Little technical glitch there. I'm sorry, Paul in Larchmont. We seem to have lost your call. I think that there's something to be said about that, about the children trying to control what they cannot control because they're finally figuring out that their world is so big. Paul, sorry, we got you back.
Okay. I just think it's interesting that it's not necessarily culturally transmitted. I think the devil thing would suggest that it would be something that would be more culturally transmitted, because superstition often originates, or I guess you should probably ask your guests this, but I'm guessing that it often originates in religion, but it can also be developed in, it seems to be innate in the psyche in some cases also.
Absolutely.
Thanks for your call, Paul.
Yes, if I can
sure.
Jump in here, the desire for control is a major factor, appears to be, in the development of superstitions. You know, we do live in a world where things are uncertain, and if the stakes are high, then many people are willing to, or looking for, some edge to make make things happen the way they would like them to. That's part of the reason why athletes are so superstitious, and people in the theater are very superstitious because, again, the stakes are high, mistakes are costly, and they really want that uncontrollable, outcome. You know, even the best baseball player only gets a hit, one out of three times. So the desire for control is a major factor, and as Paul suggests, people do develop their own superstitions. Many of them are socially transmitted, but there also are uniquely personal ones, like the lucky shirt or the some kind of personal ritual, a song that you listen to before a game or before a job interview or a test. And so they do fall into these categories of personal superstitions and also socially transmitted ones. And it's just an interesting thing that his daughter appears to have fallen upon something similar to a socially transmitted one and thinks that she came up with it herself. I've always thought that, cracks are a little bit hazardous in the pavement anyway, and so they wouldn't perhaps naturally produce a desire to step over them rather than to step on them.
We're talking about superstitions on this Friday the 13th. Stuart Weiss is professor of psychology at Connecticut College. Edmund Kern is associate professor of history at Lawrence University. And we're taking your calls at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to continue with your phone calls and your questions about superstitions. I'm Carrie Nolan in for Leonard Lopate on WNYC. I'm Carrie Nolan in for Leonard Lopate here on WNYC and WNYC.org, and we're talking about superstition on this week's Please Explain. Stuart Weiss is with me. He is professor of psychology at Connecticut College, and Edmund Kern is with us as well, associate professor of history at Lawrence University. And we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. And let's talk with Dina in Manhattan. Hi, Dina.
Oh, hi. By the way, I love the sound of your voice. I wish you'd fill in more often.
from your mouth to God's ear, my friend.
Oh, really? It's wonderful. Yeah, I was just saying, 13 has always been very lucky for me. My first job was at Channel 13. And then when I started studying Judaism, the 13 principles of belief were very important in Judaism. And then tonight is Shabbat, and it's Friday the 13th. And I think it's going to be great that I'm having guests. And when I have an opportunity to have guests on a Friday the 13th, I think that's a great thing. I think it's only going to bring me good luck.
So there's your confirmation bias, right, Stuart?
Well, at least it's a little balance to the typical view of Friday the 13th, and I love it. I think it also should be, we should recall that babies will be born today, and I think if I'm not mistaken, Stevie Wonder, whose song you've been playing at the break, was born on Friday the 13th. So it can be a very lucky day. It is Shabbat. There's all sorts of reasons why we should not fear Friday the 13th.
Dina, thanks so much for your call.
I always joke that I don't fear Friday the 13th because I'm a trained professional. So it tends to be a day of good omen for me.
We talk on the radio.
That's
right, exactly.
Why do so many superstitions involve rituals, throwing rice at weddings or let's say, why is it considered bad luck for the groom to see the bride before the wedding? You know, there are lots of life events that people tend to be kind of suspicious about. My
right.
grandmother, for example, when I was pregnant with my son, my grandmother would not buy me anything for the baby until the baby came home.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, that's very common, really, throughout the history of magic. And the simple explanation for that is that superstitions tend to operate because people reason through analogy or associations rather than through logic. And so when you draw these analogies or make these associations, you tend to rely upon the same kind of ritual forms, so to speak, despite a tremendous variety in details. So, for example, the groom not seeing the bride on the day of the wedding, that's an example of a taboo, a whole series of don'ts, things that you cannot do. Another very common form would be omens, in other words, reading signs in the natural world, and these too would be dependent upon associations. Also, frequently you find rituals dependent upon notions of sympathetic powers or metaphorical powers being put in place. So, for example, witches used to tie knots to render their victims impotent or sterile. Or, on a happier note, parents would carry their newborns upstairs in order to show that they were moving upward in life rather than downward in life. The throwing of rice at weddings, for example, is a good example of this as well, because it symbolizes abundance in the married couple's life. And so when you tend to reason through associations or analogies rather than logic, there's really a couple of basic forms that human cultures tend to rely upon over and over and over again.
Let's go to the phones. Paul in New York. Hey, Paul. What? Let's see if we can get Paul up on the air here. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for having me. My question is about possible similarities between superstitions and hypotheses, which would be the first step in the scientific process. If wouldn't a hypothesis, which presumably is based on observation and not an experiment yet, wouldn't, like a superstition maybe based on observations, wouldn't that be answerable to the confirmation bias? And therefore, compromise the ideally objective nature of the experiment that would follow, like a superstition might be answerable to the confirmation bias.
Absolutely, this is Stuart speaking. But yes, absolutely, and this is one of the potential problems with the deductive approach to scientific investigation is that a scientist whose career may depend on an experiment coming out in a particular way gets wrapped up in that and can affect his or her interpretation of the outcome and the results. That's why in the realm of science, you know, we have this thing called peer review, and we also have publication of results so that other scientists can then try to make their careers by knocking down that first finding. So but you're absolutely right. I mean, any sort of strongly held belief creates this potential for bias. I think our hope for in the world of science, our hope for finding truth comes from this back and forth approach and the ability to revise our beliefs based on new evidence.
Thank you. If I can follow up, then is there danger then in categorizing something as a superstition and thereby never allowing it to follow through with an experiment? So in a way, condemning it to be illogical from the outset by saying this is a superstition. A person would ideally not do that with a hypothesis. So this labeling could compromise something that's a superstition never being proven. What do you think about that?
So there.
I could take that up a little bit. I see the point, and I think it's a reasonable point to make. But superstitions become culturally habitual over time, and what I mean by that is that people do them out of habit. rather than following them in order to test an assertion that is being made about the natural world. You know, for example, if we were to test whether Friday the 13th, in fact, was a day of ill omen, we would have to construct some sort of experiment which would determine whether or not today was somehow qualitatively worse than yesterday or than tomorrow. Well, the superstitions and the people who practice them are not interested in those kinds of testing procedures.
Well, just to differ slightly, that is true to as far as the casual user of that superstition. But actually, there have been studies done, and people do test superstitions where data can be summoned to test them. In fact, for example, there have been tests of automobile accidents on Friday the 13th versus other Fridays. There have been tests of various variables that are supposed to be correlated with the full moon, and so where there are large sets of data that can be brought to bear, then they are. And the interesting part about it is that sometimes there are interesting findings. For example, there was a study just two or three years ago done in Finland on car accidents, and lo and behold, they discovered that there was a statistically significant increase in car accidents among women drivers in Finland. Now, that's clearly something that needs to be followed up on. Now, the question is, why would Friday the 13th be only unlucky for women and not for men? That is not clear. But nonetheless, science can be used to either confirm or disconfirm. And if the evidence is there, I think people are willing to change their view of the superstition. But I agree that the term superstition is automatically pejorative, and there may be a problem with that. I used it simply because it's such a common term, but there maybe we should think about another one.
Thanks for your call, Paul. Let's go to Dorothy in Red Bank. Hi, Dorothy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Actually, it's Fairhaven on the shore of New Jersey. There are a couple of things that I remember since I was a little girl. One is see a penny, pick it up all the day, you'll have good luck. And to tell you the truth, I do pick up a penny and make a wish. Now, I sort of added making a wish over the years, but some of my friends tell me, oh, it has to be with the date up, and it can't be a quarter or a dime or something. But I think one of the professors said that it's kind of conditional. You just sort of, if you make a wish, you kind of work very hard to make it happen. So you can believe in this superstition. And the other is, of course, what everyone knows, I guess, the first star you see in the evening in mm-hmm. the sky, you can wish on it, but you may not look at it again that evening, or your wish won't come true. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if...
I love that. I've always loved that one about wishing on a star, the first star of the evening.
Right. Jiminy Cricket.
Exactly. Yeah. Thanks for your call, Dorothy, in Fairhaven. a few years ago, when the avian flu epidemic was occurring in Asia, there were reports that superstition about the disease was common in rural villages in Cambodia. What makes that kind of superstition so typical?
Well, I'll jump in. I think that any time that you don't have an explanation, when things seem to be random, mm-hmm. And you cannot come up with a more logical explanation, then you're going to grasp at that. People use what is common to them, what they know, and in rural Cambodia, then scientific thinking about disease and how it's spread may not be as common as it is here. And other beliefs are so. I think people use what they know and to make meaning out of what they experience. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would just like to echo that. I think that periods of social stress or anxiety are particularly conducive to what we might call superstitious practices because of the uncertainty inherent in the moment, and relying upon ritual behaviors or ritual practices restores some semblance of control. We see that, I think, on a much smaller scale in our own culture when we take a look at the prevalence of superstitions surrounding moments of transition, whether it's something like the birth of a baby or the wedding day. There tends to be a whole host of superstitious practices clustered around those moments of transition, because those moments are potentially dangerous, because they are uncertain.
Mm-hmm.
And so relying upon these beliefs and actions restores a feeling of control over something which is, you know, ultimately beyond any one individual's control.
Let me ask you this. Where does superstition end and, let's say, a disorder begin?
Well, the disorder that's probably the closest is obsessive compulsive disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference there, I think, first of all, I interviewed for my book, Believing in Magic, The Psychology of Superstition. I interviewed a fellow who has obsessive compulsive disorder. He was very articulate about it, and he suggested that in his case it was a quantitative difference that became qualitatively different, that he also took no pleasure out of his, you know, rituals that he had to do. He was compelled to do them and didn't enjoy them, but he couldn't see a way to stop. And I think that's a bit different from the normal kind of superstition that people engage in more voluntarily. And so most professionals, and I'm not a clinical psychologist, but most professionals, I think that the two are different. It's not that you sort of get carried away with superstitions and become obsessive compulsive in the process.
Can somebody just stop being superstitious, is that something that's so hardwired into us?
It does become a habit, of course, like anything else, and like any other habit, it's going to be difficult to change. It's going to feel uncomfortable. Often superstitions are a way of dealing with anxiety, and so therefore, you know, if you don't do the superstition, you have to experience the anxiety, or create some other kind of way to cope with it.
Mm-hmm.
So it is difficult. I have heard of people who have attempted to do it cold turkey, but I would also argue that in many cases it's not a bad thing. I mean, this is, my skeptical friends will probably think that this is a heretical thing to say, but most everyday superstitions are fairly harmless and not costly. There may be a slight amount of embarrassment involved in them, but if they provide a psychological support, then I'm not entirely opposed to them. There are examples where I would be opposed, as in the case of telephone psychics that are quite expensive,
mm-hmm.
or superstitions that sort of sustain gambling or other you know, counterproductive activities.
And that, gentlemen, unfortunately, is where we have to leave it. We are completely out of time. Thank you so much, Stuart Weiss, professor of psychology at Connecticut College and the author of Believing in Magic, The Psychology of Superstition, and Edmund Kern, who is associate professor of history at Lawrence University. He's the author of The Magic of Harry Potter, What Our Favorite Hero Teaches Us About Moral Choices. I hope you have a very uneventful Friday the 13th. Thanks so much again for being with us.
Thank you.
Yes, thanks for having me.
I'm Carrie Nolan, in for Leonard Lopate on WNYC.